brings us to the final chapter of the unit. And this one has to do with the other major job of DNA. We just got done looking at replication. That's one of its functions. The other function, remember, is transcription. And transcription is the only part, it is only part of a bigger process. Do you remember what the bigger process is? Transcription is just half of it. What happens after transcription?
Translation.
And we're going to look at both, even though only one of them involves DNA. That's why I say that the second job of DNA is transcription, not the overall process that transcription is part of. The overall process, which includes transcription first and then translation, is called gene expression. And that's the focus of this chapter. So we'll deal with more than just DNA here. But this is another historically important experiment that we're looking at the results of in slide one before we figured out how DNA works, or as we were figuring out, I should say. In this one, they worked with mold, a fungus that they were growing in the lab, and they were irradiating it or exposing it to ultraviolet radiation, which, as you know, causes mutations like us, skin cancer in us. So they had no idea what kinds of mutations they were making. They didn't really care. They were just causing mutations to happen much more quickly than they would happen by accident. And the mutations were damaging, changing the DNA of these fungal cells. And notice what they're examining here to figure out what's happening is a biochemical pathway. So you start with a precursor molecule. That gets turned into ornithine by the first reaction, which then gets turned into citrulline by the second reaction, which then gets turned into arginine. So it's a biochemical pathway. And we already know, they didn't at the time, well, I mean, they didn't know the DNA contribution, but we already know from studying biochemical pathways that each individual step is catalyzed by its own enzyme. Okay? Well, when they used mold that was not exposed to UV and therefore was healthy, normal, they could give it simply minimal medium. The stuff it's growing on is called the medium. And minimal medium just gives it the bare necessities for living, including the precursor molecule. So all they were giving it was precursor. And what they noticed is that these normal cells could go through the whole pathway to make arginine, which they need to live. That's why they're growing in all of these tubes. Okay? But on the ones, second, third, and fourth columns, these ones were mutants. And some of the mutants, well, none of the mutants would grow on minimal medium, where all they gave them was the precursor. Okay? Some of them, though, would grow if you gave them minimal medium and then just some ornithine. And what they noticed is that, well, we're just giving them ornithine so that they don't have to go through this first step. After that, they can go all the way to arginine. These ones grew if they gave them citrulline, so this step seemed to not work. And similarly, enzyme C seemed to not work on this one. But if they gave them arginine, then it would live. So what they deduced from this is that genes, which is the DNA that they're damaging with the irradiation, genes must be corresponding to enzymes. And they devised what was called the one gene, one enzyme hypothesis, which is wrong, as it turns out, for multiple reasons. But that was the original name, one gene, one enzyme. They said what a gene is instructions for how to build one enzyme. And one reason why that's wrong is that while it is true that every enzyme requires a gene to code for it, it's not true that every gene codes for an enzyme. Enzymes are proteins, right? But there's all kinds of other proteins. And genes are needed to code for those other proteins as well. So it's not one gene, one enzyme. Well, they eventually renamed it the one gene, one protein hypothesis, which is a little closer to the truth, but that's still wrong. One reason it's wrong is because of what you know about proteins already. You've learned it at least. Remember we talked about the levels of protein structure? Primary, secondary, tertiary, quaternary. And some proteins, the multimeric proteins, are made up of actually more than one polypeptide. Well, in those multimeric proteins, each individual polypeptide actually requires its own gene. So hemoglobin, which is four overall polypeptides, but two identical of one type and two identical of another type, that requires two genes, not one. So that's one reason it's wrong, the one gene, one protein hypothesis. And so they revised it again into the one gene, one polypeptide hypothesis. Each gene is corresponding to a polypeptide according to that hypothesis. And that is closer still to the truth, but it's still wrong. And there's a couple reasons why that's wrong. One is that not every gene codes for a polypeptide. Now, actually, no gene codes directly for a polypeptide. When a gene gets transcribed, which is what genes do, in every case, the direct product of transcription is an RNA molecule. Transcription of DNA allows the cell to build a corresponding RNA molecule. In most cases, for most genes is what I mean here, the specific RNA that gets produced is a version of RNA called messenger RNA, mRNA. And it's mRNA that now holds the information that was in the gene. The gene is done. DNA's job is done at the end of transcription. mRNA now then goes on in the process of gene expression, which is translation. The next step is translation. And mRNA tells the ribosome how to assemble a polypeptide. So the gene only indirectly corresponds to a polypeptide, right? What the gene directly corresponds to, though, is mRNA. And in the vast majority of genes, it is mRNA that gets produced in transcription. So that after that, translation can build the protein. And those genes, which are most genes, are called protein-coding genes for that reason. The final product after translation is a polypeptide or a protein. Well, protein coding genes are most genes, but they are not all genes. There are also non-protein coding genes. They do the same thing, meaning they hold information so that when they get transcribed, that allows the cell to know how to assemble an RNA molecule. Transcription always makes RNA. But in the case of a non-protein coding gene, it's a different kind of RNA compared to mRNA. mRNA is just one of many types of RNA. A cell doesn't have the ability to assemble any RNA molecule without instructions, explicit instructions for how to do that. And that's what a gene is. The gene tells the cell explicitly how to build a specific RNA molecule. All right? Well, when a non-protein coding gene gets transcribed, it's some other RNA besides mRNA that gets produced. And we'll talk about other kinds of RNA besides mRNA. They have to be produced as well. And that's what non-protein coding genes are for. And that's why even one gene, one polypeptide is wrong. because not all genes correspond to polypeptides. Another reason it's wrong, which we'll look at later, is that in eukaryotes, it's actually possible for one gene to code for any of several different polypeptides, just with the same gene. And that's because once the mRNA gets produced by that gene in transcription, the RNA can be rearranged so that it codes for different polypeptides. So there's two reasons, main reasons, why even the most restrictive hypothesis name, one gene, one polypeptide hypothesis, is still wrong. They just stopped renaming it after a while. But that all started with this important experiment. Now, in slide two, we're once again comparing the two kinds of cells. Prokaryotic cell on the top, eukaryotic cell on the bottom. Both of them need this overall process we're talking about, which is gene expression, because all living cells vitally need proteins of different sorts to do all the important jobs that proteins perform in cells. And neither kind of cell is able to assemble a polypeptide without being told how to do it. So both kinds of cells need transcription and translation, which together make up gene expression. They happen more or less the same way. There's some differences, but one difference, of course, between the cells is that there's only one compartment in a prokaryotic cell because it doesn't have any membrane-bounded organelles, including the nucleus. Whereas a eukaryotic cell does have a true nucleus, of course. And that makes the process a little bit more complicated in a eukaryotic cell. A bacterium is representing a prokaryotic cell, but it would occur the same way in an archaean. In a prokaryotic cell, both parts of gene expression are able to happen in the same compartment because there is only one compartment. Transcription in any cell, prokaryotic or otherwise, has to happen where the DNA is because DNA is involved in transcription. But in a prokaryotic cell, the DNA is just part of that one chamber, the cytoplasm. So transcription uses the code in DNA to figure out how to build an mRNA, a messenger RNA molecule, the red thing. DNA's job is done at that point. It's there just to tell the cell how to build the mRNA. The mRNA then goes on in the process of translation to instruct the ribosome, which we've looked at a little bit before. As a molecular machine, the ribosome reads the mRNA to figure out how many amino acids and which ones in each position need to be added together to form a polypeptide. So that's what translation is in gene expression. It's the actual assembly of the polypeptide. Pretty straightforward in a prokaryotic cell. But in a eukaryotic cell, the DNA, of course, is in its own compartment. So that's where transcription has to take place, in the nucleus. That produces the mRNA, just as it does for a prokaryotic cell, except that it's not only within this compartment, which is a problem because the ribosomes are out in another compartment. That problem didn't exist in a prokaryotic cell. So that's one big difference. The mRNA needs to be able to get out of the nucleus. But also, the mRNA that's produced in a prokaryotic cell is already ready to go for translation. It doesn't need to be modified. But in a eukaryotic cell, once transcription is done and you have the mRNA molecule, that mRNA molecule is not ready to go. It needs to be modified. And we call that modification, since it's occurring after transcription, post-transcriptional modification of RNA. Okay, notice that some yellow ends have been added to this mRNA. That's one way that it gets modified. We'll talk about a different way as well. But this is why we call the stuff that comes directly off of the transcription assembly line in a eukaryotic cell pre-mRNA. It's not yet ready to go. It gets modified into the mature version, which we can just call mRNA. And then that mRNA needs to be able to leave that compartment it's in, the nucleus, and get out into the cytoplasm, which is where the ribosomes are, so that it can be used to instruct the ribosomes in the process of translation how to make the sequence of amino acids that will make up the polypeptide. This is why the nuclear envelope is perforated. It has a bunch of nuclear pores that we talked about before. Those nuclear pores are a way for messenger RNA to get out of the nucleus into the cytoplasm and meet up with the ribosome. So we'll look at the particulars of that, but I'll pause there because we will have time for this.